Irreverent. Entertaining. Cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument, and has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro, and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight. I'm very, very honored to have Bill Champlin on the show. Welcome, Bill. It's really a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Jeff.
Hold on a second. Make sure I got your mic right.
Yeah. Oh, he must not be in cardioid.
That's there
for,
you go.
Yeah. Except for my wife was sometimes saying, "Man, somebody hurt his neck, and she hurt her cardioid artery." And I went, "Oops, I think you've been around the studio a little too long." Yeah.
Well, it's great to have you here. And
excuse me to start with, I've got hay fever I brought from the East Coast. I got a lot. Want some?
That's okay. I'll pass.
Just seeing if I can pass it around a little bit.
Well, a lot of people know Bill from being in Chicago for many years, but his career is just amazing. He's done all sorts of stuff as a singer, keyboardist. He is a guitarist and a great guitarist, you're going to hear in a second. Songwriter, producer, he does it all. And
empty the garbage, too.
You do that?
Oh, yes.
You do that.
I know Garbage Night.
But for you trivia nuts, he was one of the co-writers for After the Love Is Gone for Earth, Wind & Fire, big hit.
Yeah.
You and I think Jay Graydon and David Foster collaborated. And then also, which is kind of funny, we were talking about this, you, Jay Graydon, and Steve Lukather wrote Turn Your Love Around for another guitar player, George Benson. So three guitar players writing for another one.
Yeah, and the other one that we were writing for could take us all to the cleaners, at least in terms of bebop, anything. You know? I mean, Luke's ridiculous. I mean, he's probably one of the best guitar players on the earth, but George is, there's only one.
Oh, yeah.
That's George Benson. I heard somebody play me a solo he did just a couple of years ago, and it just went on and on and on. I was going, man. That's why they call him George Benson.
That's why.
Unbelievable. Great singer. Too.
Great, but both of those songs, great songs. And also just the list of some of the people who you worked with, Al Jarreau, George Duke, Boss Skaggs, Elton John.
Yeah, I went to high school with George Duke. We played in the marching band together.
Really?
Yeah, I played baritone sax and he played trombone.
Really?
You know, trombone, it's a hand-operated, wind-driven pitch approximator. Well, you can thank Carmen for that one. I got it from him. No, George. I've known George since high school. He was just an amazingly great musician, even back then. I mean, we're talking.
And one of the nicest guys. He was just.
You know, when George passed, somebody said, "You want to say something about him?" I said, "Well, George was always who George always was. No matter how big he was, no matter how big a hit he was. You know, a lot of people, the minute you get in the top 10, you're a different guy." George was just always George, man. He was this kind, sweet man.
Yeah.
And, you know, his wife, Corrine, was the same way. They were just a sweet, sweet people. I mean, George was always a good guy.
He was one year when I was, because I used to go to the NAMM show when I was younger. My dad would take me in. Yeah. I met the guy that did the Moog synthesizer work on the 7-Up commercial, did the fizz and the pop.
Yeah.
Big guy, forget his name. And I asked him how he did that, and he's like, "Well, I can't tell you that. It's a secret." And I was, like, really bummed, you know. And so I walked down the hall, and there's George Duke. And I said, how did you get that sound on, I forget the album that he did, and he goes, hold on a second. He pulled out a piece of paper and diagrammed the patch for the mini moog.
Wrote it down.
That's the way he was.
Yeah, I mean, you know, hey, it belongs to all of us. I mean, that's just, yeah, I don't want to get off too far on George, but there was never anybody like him. We grew up in Marin County. I mean, we went to the same high school in Mill Valley, California.
Well,
how's that for a ghetto? Right?
Yeah. But I'm going to open up with a clip. I'm going to play this clip, give you a flashback back to 1969. It's from the Sons of Champlin's Loosen Up Naturally album. This is a clip, but you got to check this.
I need to explain what's happened with that in that band and then almost every other band that I've been in. With that band, we had a guy named Terry Haggerty, who was probably one of the... Was that me?
That's me. That's me trying to write this down.
Yeah. Terry Haggerty was the original guitar player with the Sons, and he's the one that got most of the attention because he was the first guy to really play hard preamp, hard rock guitars, but using jazz licks outside of the pentatonic scale.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's one of the first guys. I know the guys in Chicago telling me Terry Kaff brought in an album and said, listen to this motherfucker. He's better than shit. And Terry started, you know, he was like the kind of predated McLaughlin and some of these guys, you know. But a lot of people go up to him even at this point and say, man, that first album was great, man. I loved your playing on it, man. The blues solos, the bluesy solos you did were really great. And Terry's going, that's actually Bill. and people didn't know it because they knew me as an organ player. And there was a great organ solo on the record, but it was actually Jeff Palmer, who was an amazingly great musician, plays vibes, organ, tablas, bass, drums, you name it, he played it, you know. So that was what the Sons were about. In this particular clip you got, it wasn't a really great song, but the solo was pretty cool. That was the one I played through with Terry's rig. I actually used his Gibson L5, which is a fat body guitar, through a twin reverb, and we had, out of the external speaker jack, we borrowed this fiberglass horn. You know, those are normally used for coming out of chute number three. We have thunderballs, you know, or whatever. You know, not a really great thing, but the twin, the 212s, and the twin, and that thing together made some serious.
So you had the regular, the twin with the two speakers, and then you had the horn.
The twins were beefed. We beefed them up a little bit, so they were, and they. I think the twins had Electric Voice SROs in them.
Oh, they were electric. Okay,
yeah. Yeah. As opposed to the Lansings. Twins are usually, they sound like you're running through formica. There's not much give.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a super or a concert has a little more give in it.
Yeah.
Twins were always basically, right off the showroom floor, they were always a little hard. Uh-huh. Little hard sound. There's not much forgiveness in them. Well, and with the SROs, there was.
Well, the sound of this guitar is one of the I love this. I would strive to try to get
the same tone Terry used on a song called Freedom, and people know that solo until the cows come home. But I say, well, since I'm there, I have to listen to one of mine.
Well, let me play the clip and take a listen to this. But this tone is to die for. This is great. This is called Don't Find It, Do It.
Yeah. Go, man, go, 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 man, go, get off, go, 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 go.
Trade-off on the guitars there, but that you can hear the horn. You can hear a little bit of that, like that little distortion in the horn.
Yeah, yeah. But that thing just gave it, especially when you're on the treble. Ooh, man, it would just cut. It would, you know.
And that amp was up full.
Yeah, Amp was probably around 5 or 6. You know, I wasn't really. I mean, we had those twins beefed. I wish I had them now. But those twins also were probably the reason that I had quadruple hernia surgery later, because the SROs were 25-pound magnets.
Oh yeah.
So you it was the kind of thing where you go to pick up the amp and the amp stays on the floor and your arm stretches. I mean, my God, those things weighed a ton. And what was weird is we used to burn out. You know, it was like 3 gigs to a set of tubes.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to drive over to Leo's Music and get power tubes. I'd get 100 of them for $3 a piece. And nowadays, those same tubes would be damn near $100 for enough tubes to change it. Something because there's not a lot of people making tubes anymore. So, you know.
Well, those tubes back then must have been RCAs, right?
Yeah, those were the main thing. And we went to Leo's Music in Berkeley. And that was a big company, and I just ordered a couple of cases. We just go around, and I just keep both me and Hag. And
you went through a lot of tubes?
Oh, ridiculous.
Really?
Especially with the way we beefed it. It was just nailing them.
Oh, okay. So you were...
You know, it's almost like railroading the amplifiers. It was eating up all the guts.
A lot of current through those puppies.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everybody else was playing. I mean, I remember we did a gig, and something went wrong with my amp. I think I blew a fuse in my amp, and we were playing a gig with Steve Miller. Mm-hmm. He said, "Hey, Bill, just use my Marshall." And that was the only time I've ever played through an amplifier that was bigger than my knees. I just don't want it up there where it can hurt me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's like, "Hey, you guys are mighty fine." Oh, about 10:30. You know, your hearing and just go, you know.
Well, those twins, they were pretty powerful.
They could crank, yeah. Well, we cranked them pretty hard. And actually, we borrowed that horn, that fiberglass horn, just for the album. We didn't use them live.
Mm-hmm.
So our tone wasn't as, you know, I mean, both mine and Terry's tone wasn't as nasty. But we had it set up in this little ISO booth, and I said, "Hey, Terry, let me use your guitar and knock off the solo." He said, "Sure." And I went, "Whoa, this is fun." One time I did play through a Marshall. It was in Cologne, Germany. Somebody gave me a Marshall amp. It was a combo amp, small amp. It was called an 8080. Mm-hmm. You ever heard of it?
Mm-hmm.
It was like the clean was solid state, and you'd hit the button to dirty, and it was tubes.
Oh, wow.
It was pretty cool. So the solid state, your rhythm, clean, kind of nasty, you know, funk, what we used to call skank rhythms, were all really clean as a whistle. And then you go to the dirt and forget about it. Sustained for days. That Marshall thing.
I'm surprised you guys didn't use those acoustic cabinets with the horn and the two Altecs.
We did at one point. Somebody gave us some, I don't even think they were acoustics, but we did it at one point.
And to get that sound.
Yeah, we were starting to get other amplifiers and stuff like that. But I think at some point Terry bailed on both of us. I mean, I had an ES-175. He had an L5. But we were swinging with fat-bodied guitars.
Because there was the only other guy that used to use horns in his guitar rig was John Cipollina.
Guess what? You mean those little big, those trombone?
He had those horns. Like big, yeah. Those
things were he didn't run through those.
Oh, he didn't really use them?
That was bullshit. John was a sweetie pie, man. He was one of my favorite people ever. One of the nicest guys on the earth.
Uh-huh.
And when I was a real little kid, I was like 14, I was hanging out with, it was before Quicksilver, before the San Francisco scene. I was hanging out with a guy named Adam Foreman, who was a piano player, mm-hmm. drummer, singer, also a guitar player. Great guy, but he was in this band with John, and they were playing a gig at the Sausalito Women's Club. And Adam said, "Well, just pick you up, come on to the gig, hang out with us." So I'm backstage and stuff like that. I'm like 14. And at some point in the game, they're playing, and it's a sock hop and everything. And John says, "Hey, I got another guitar, I got a second guitar and amp. Here, Bill, come on, play with us." It was the first time. First time I'd ever been on a stage playing rock and roll, especially with a guitar. And it was John that handed it to me. And then I worked later on with Mario, John's little brother.
Mm-hmm.
Mario played bass with Huey for years and years. Mm-hmm. And it's just a great family that just lived right up the street from me in Mill Valley.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your background and your influences.
Okay.
What you were into. So,
well, jail. No, I'm just joking. What was I into? Jail. Mom.
When did you start
Bail.
Playing? Bail. Yeah. When did you start playing?
Actually, I started playing guitar. I lived in Santa Barbara when I was... My parents got divorced when I was about five and a half or six. Moved to Santa Cruz for a while, then moved to Santa Barbara, and that's when I discovered Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
So next thing you know, I got a broomstick with a piece of rope hanging around my neck going, "This feels right." So I got a guitar, but the strings were in a different... When somebody got me a guitar, the strings were so high off the neck, they were in a different zip code as the neck. And I was trying to play it, and I was just this kid, and it just wasn't working. And it wasn't until I got to Mill Valley, I moved to Mill Valley right before seventh grade, and I started getting into it.
So you first started on guitar, not...
No,
keyboard?
I started on piano when my parents were still together. I took piano lessons when I was 3 and a half to 5.
Wow.
Yeah. My mom was a songwriter. She's crazy as a junkyard dog. Out of her mind, you know, alcohol is a fun thing, you know. Better living through chemistry. But she would just put me in a playpen, put me under the piano and write stuff. And then she'd get all pissed off and burn it, whatever it was she wrote, you know. But she had a few tunes here.
Three and a half. That's...
Yeah, and I remember my piano teacher was a woman named Mrs. Chamblin, B-L-I-N. And she was real cool. But then when my parents got divorced, we moved to Santa Cruz. We moved up this dirt road. And they couldn't get our piano into a small enough vehicle to get up the dirt road. So that was kind of the end of my plan. And around that time, I decided I'd rather be either a cowboy or a fireman for about 4 or 5 years. And then I started to dig trumpet. And then Elvis came along. I went, guitar is cool. So I started to get into guitar. And I actually finally eventually got to where I could make
it. Well, what did you listen to get you in a trumpet?
Oh, jazz.
Jazz. Okay, yeah, so
there was a big band called Sodder and Finnegan. It was the craziest shit you ever heard in your life. Out of whack stuff. And, you know, my mom was into Ema Sumac. And, you know, but at the same time, she was into Satchmo.
Oh, okay.
She was a giant Nat King Cole fan before Nat sang. Because Nat was a great piano player. Mm-hmm. And he had a really cool trio. It was just him and a guitar and drums. I don't think they had a bass player. Or maybe it was just him and bass and drums. I don't know, whatever it was. It was
a really
small group, and his playing was so great. And then he opened his mouth, and everybody even loved him that much more. Such a great singer. Mm. And then later on, I think at some point in the game, when I got to Mill Valley, I was playing guitar, and there was a radio station that was based in AM. There was no FM at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a radio station in Oakland, California, mm-hmm. KDIA, which is the R&B station, mm-hmm. that was mainly for, you know, they were aiming at, you know, at Oakland and, you know, mm-hmm. East 14th, and it was all R&B. So, I mean, I was hearing Lou Rawls. I remember the first time I heard Lou Rawls, I couldn't believe it. It was St. James Infirmary off his Black and Blue album. It was scary good. I was just going, whatever this is, I want it, you know. So he was my teacher for 3 or 4 years without him knowing it, and then we became friends later
mm-hmm.
on.
But was Lou the one that got you into singing?
Yeah.
So you
more than anybody. I mean, I was a good singer. I knew what was going on, but it just went left turn into phrasing. I mean, Lou Rawls, his early, especially, I mean, I think his first hit was Tobacco Road, but he had an album out before that. And actually, remember Sam Cooke's If You Ever Change Your Mind? Mm-hmm. Remember there was a duet? It was two people? The other guy was Lou.
Oh, wow.
They were in, I think Pilgrim Travelers was the name of their gospel group together, and they were based out of Chicago.
Wow.
And Lou was like one of the guys in that group. So I was way into that. I mean, Arthur Prysock and Ernie Andrews, a lot of really good singers, Joe Williams. All these guys were great, but Lou just was so sexy. It was just scary good.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of really, really eyeballed him for phrasing more than anything else. And his phrasing was kind of on the back end. So I kind of went, if I'm playing guitar, if I'm playing a solo or something, if I'm playing right, if I'm doing what I should be doing, I try to phrase it the way Lou would sing it. Mm. And then I got at one point I was playing keyboards and guitar, especially with the early Sons, and I found myself for guitar, the guy that really turned me around and the album that turned me around was Born Under a Bad Sign by Albert King.
Oh, wow.
That was ridiculous. A great record. Not so much. His leads on a few things were really great, but, you know, once you heard his five licks, you heard his five licks. Great five licks and performed beautifully. But what was cool on that album is the rhythm guitar playing that Steve Cropper was playing it was ridiculous.
That's right, Steve Cropper was on
his, think about the Hunter. Oh, man, his rhythm playing was just great. Mm-hmm. And I've worked with Steve on some other things before. He's a great guy.
Yeah.
Sweetie Pie, one of the best rhythm guitar players in the world. He found the right thing for the right place.
Yeah, he knew where to put it.
And that kind of, he taught me more than... Because a lot of times when you're playing rhythm guitar, it's almost like you're playing conga drums with strings, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Between the strings and the pick, you're going, you know. And sometimes it just gets to where it becomes a horse race. And Steve was the guy that would find the things that really meant something and not play the rest of the shit.
Mm-hmm.
It was really cool. And I just kind of went, wow, that's placed so nicely. And it's just like the way Lou placed his phrasing vocally.
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself, if I learned a lick on guitar, I'd take it over to the Hammond organ and try to play it on the Hammond. If I learned a lick on the Hammond, I'd take it over to the guitar, try to play it on the guitar,
right.
And see if I could get that cross move to where. And so, I mean, if I play an organ with somebody, half the time I'm playing rhythm guitar on a really big piece of piece of gear.
Yeah.
You know, I'll pick up the guitar and it'll be fine. I'll pick up the organ, I'll get a hernia. You know, but something to be said about it, you know?
Can you show us? Grab the guitar and tell us, show us what you're talking about with Cropper.
I think I got the acoustic in. Let me get a pick.
And while you're getting the pick, one question, too, is did your trombone playing affect your phrasing? Because that's all breathing.
No, I don't play trombone. I played baritone sax.
Baritone? Oh, you played. Okay. Yeah.
Hey, man, a saxophone with a spit valve? My kind of gear.
There you go.
You know, I think it was on the Hunter. It was like, they call me. Well, let's find out what came out. They call me the Hunter. That's my name. And then. That'd be Albert's stuff, but Steve's going. Wait a minute. That kind of thing. But dig this. You know.
He does a little.
Steve would have, and then Steve also invented this. You know, this business. Kind of stuff. Womack, all the Womack's records were like that. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of those kind of moves on those kind of records. I always really loved just as a rhythm guitar move. You know?
Well, you were talking about that kind of guitar playing we used to call skanking.
Yeah.
And was Cropper the guy who started
that? No, Cropper was, there was something about Stax Volt. Cropper always had really, really cool kind of stuff. When I'm talking skank, I'm talking Ray Parker. I mean, you know, there's nobody on the earth like Ray Parker. I mean, his rhythm playing is just off the chain. Right? Mm-hmm. Always has been, always will be. He's just one of the best. And, you know, I mean, there's Al McKay, there's Ray Parker. There's a guy that there are two guys that played on Michael Jackson's stuff. Paul Jackson Jr., of course, he's like the scientist of rhythm guitar. He's just, mm-hmm. just a great player. And I forget the other guy because he passed away a few years ago, and I just... who played on some of Michael's stuff. He came up with on Billie Jean.
Oh, I'm trying to remember who that was.
Williams. Oh, God, what's his first name? Williams is his last name, and I've forgotten his first name, and I should just be shot that Sunday. Because he was so good. It was just, he just had a feel that wouldn't quit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I think, what rhythm guitar, this is kind of weird. I know I've said this before, but... somehow, it used to be that when you do tracks, you're cutting tracks, you'd have the first thing that would go on the rhythm date with the bass player and drums is rhythm guitar. And then at some point, especially in the sessions around L.A., there would be, you know, Jay Graydon or Steve Lukather, whoever was playing, Landau. These guys would kind of play rhythm on the first track and then go put in the hard guitars and the nasty stuff. And, mm-hmm. and the other, or the you know, maybe the B section, what would you call it? Chorusy stuff. That's kind
yeah.
of, you know.
Well, they do the fills and
you
the
know,
riffs.
And then Landau's ridiculous with his volume pedal. I mean, he can yeah. play all this kind of stuff. It's almost like a synthesizer. It's just so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But the best rig master anywhere. I mean, in terms of him and a Bradshaw, and a guitar and just amazing musicianship. Ooh, just you know, you want it, you'll get it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean, well, Tim Pierce is the same way. He's a real good,
yes.
you know, real major. Rigmaster.
Well, all of those guys, Lukather, Rittenour, yeah. all of those guys were did all that cool stuff.
They all know those little toys, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Look, this is my rack I use live. I got a tuner, an OCD, and a super chorus.
Right.
That's it. And the only reason I use the chorus is it keeps... It's because I've had... I mean, you got to realize I'm not that good a player, so...
I don't know. You sound pretty good to me.
Well, I mean, I got a thing going, but, I mean, every band that I've ever been in, there's always been a really much better player in there, and I'm just kind of waiting for, you know... I mean, I played with Danny Seraphim. We got Mark Mania on guitar. Mm. Mark's monster. He's just a monster. With the Sons, I got Carmen Grillo on guitar. I mean, he could just play circles around me when it comes to solos and stuff like that. I'm kind of better in the studio layering stuff and putting stuff in. That's mm-hmm. kind of my move. And I just kind of noticed at one point there, people started using Michael Thompson, who is just a monster. Yeah, he's just as good as it gets. But Michael would do this on the opening track. He'd play some of the fills, and he would it would be like all of it in one pass, which is amazing. But people forgot to put skank. So that skank thing started to go away because, I mean, he was doing such great tracks that you go, sounds fun. It sounds done to me. Good he is.
Do me a favor and demonstrate, because not everybody knows what skanking is.
Well, skank is just, you know, it's just... Oh, I should turn it on. Oh. You know, that's just kind of basic. Everybody just calls it skank.
No, that's what they...
It sounds like somebody we all went to high school with. nothing.
Well, I'm going to play a clip that I thought was really cool. This is called Maybe Little Hip Dreams.
Well, the song's Maybe. It's an old tune. Actually, I wrote
this.
Oh,
it's called Maybe? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, and the album's called Hip Little Dreams.
Okay, I get it.
And this song, basically it was, I think it was me and Tal Morris, who played with the Sons at the time, and we ended up just switching back and forth on leads on it. But and we had, I think, Tom Saviano and Steve Madeo were on horns on this one.
Yeah.
At the time, Mick Gillette was a member of the Sons, but he just had a heart attack. Mm. It was his first. His second one took him out.
Well, who was doing the flanged lead?
I think that was me.
That was you. And then there's the regular.
Yeah. You know what? I had a little box. I just ran it through the.
But who was doing all the little funky rhythm things? There's a couple of layers.
Me, mostly.
Okay. Well, it's some of the classic, if you want to call it funk type of rhythm. This is really.
Yeah, this song, I originally wrote it for Lydia Pence, and she never heard it until 25 years later. I played it for her band, taught it to her band, and she never listened to it.
Well, let's take a listen. This is Maybe.
You got the time, and you feel good. Just a couple of dimes, and you can call me.
That's a great cut.
Man, I forgot how funky that is. That thing's funkier than a three-day-old Band-Aid.
Yeah, but the leads are great.
I was just a little box I got from Korg when I was in Japan. That's what I was playing through. That first solo of that back and forth was me, and then it was Tal. Tal's the one with the chops. I'm the one with the bullshit.
What was he using for that? Do you remember?
I think he just went straight through his amp. Probably had a little
But
OCD
how did you get
something.
That real glassy, chorusy...
Over the rhythm?
Yeah, because there's a couple of different rhythm things.
It
kind of
sounds compressed. Sounds like a real compressed.
Was that direct through the board?
No, I think I probably went through an amp, but it might as well have been direct. Because it could have been direct through the board. I have no idea.
But what guitar would you use? Because that's a really... Was that a Strat?
I think I was using a Mine, M-I-N-E. It's like a Strat copy. Mm-hmm. Somebody gave me in Japan, and it had a synth out on it. So it weighed a ton, But it's a good guitar. It had an ebony neck on it. It's a real sweet guitar.
Because it has that real glassy sound that, that was really nice.
Yeah, I kind of like that.
And then you had your that riff that you're doing in the middle.
I found something in that box that had a little...
It sounded kind of like a Leslie's type of thing, but it was a very cool sound.
Yeah.
Was that still the Mina?
Yeah, I use the same guitar for everything.
Same the guitar?
Yeah. I mean, if you put it through stuff, you find something. And, you know, I mean, I'm not... doing those things as a guitar player, I'm doing those things as a producer.
Right.
You know, to try to give us different, you know, so that session to session does different stuff. And that's what I love about guitar, and that's why I love about, you know, Mike Landau and Luke and those guys. They really know their goodies. You know, they know their toys as good as anybody. And those toys really bring up, you know, they open up what guitar can do for a record. I was in Sweden one time, and I happened to go with a friend of mine, Andreas Carlson, big songwriter and singer and just major guy, right? And I went to Sharon, where they were producing Britney Spears and Backstreet Boys and stuff like that. I went down these stairs down to the studio, and I looked around, and I saw a pod in the corner. I said, "You mean you don't use Marshalls on your records?" He said, "I don't even use guitar on my records." And I went, "Oh,
that's
okay then." And it was Max Martin. It was, you know, and it was funny because he was mixing... Where do you wanna do Celine Dion's record? We could hear it from upstairs and went, "That is a hit. Whatever that is, it's a beautiful."
It was.
Yeah, good piece of music. And I went down there and listened to it, and they had one of those Focusrite. I can't remember what the board was, a really good mixing board, but none of the reverbs worked. And I had told some friend of mine of something that Tris Impoten told me one time, when there's no reverb on a record, he said, "Man, that's drier than a popcorn fart." So I told it to a friend of mine like 4 years before, and somehow, you know, I listened to the mix, and I went to Max. I said, "Dude, there's no reverb on this." He says, "Yeah, it's drier than a popcorn fart." I just realized Tris, in telling me, had pretty much told Sweden now it's a sonic term in Sweden. Pretty guy makes some good records still at the top of the heap. You know?
No, but the interplay too. But what you're doing, you're it's a form of orchestration, the way you're playing those guitars.
Yeah, I mean, I've always thought that when you listen to, you know, if you listen to Stravinsky or Prokofiev, any of those real the major guys, right, that are out there, especially the Russians. I think it's the vodka and black bread that do it to you. But you realize that what the function that hard guitar, bah, 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 I mean, when Hendrix, I think probably right when Hendrix first did it, it was the first time I heard anybody do a guitar double. I think it was on "Hey Joe," right?
Mm-hmm.
"Hey Joe, where you going with that deal in your hand?" Whatever, and then he goes, you know that when I heard that double with the bass, I just went, "Man, that's like trombones in an orchestra."
Yeah.
And I went, "Oh, now we're looking at," you know, he had a trio, but on some of the stuff he did on records, it was as orchestrated as a orchestra.
Yeah.
And I kind of went, "There's, you know, hard burn buzzsaw guitars." I would just say, "Well, that's trombone parts. That's like a trombone thing in a way, a trombone or a E flat baritone horn or something down in that range. It just lifts the thing up."
Well, speaking of down there too, I have to say that the bass player on "Maybe," monster.
That was David Shalik. I think he was the best bass player the Suns ever had. He was just so great. We got Dick Mathune playing with us now. He's good. But Shalik had a feel that wouldn't quit. He's a great guitar player also.
Great tone.
He actually just retired about, I want to say, 4 or 5 years ago. He just had enough. And he says, "Man, I'm just not enough of a musician to do your shit." I said, "Bullshit, man. Your feel is ridiculous." But, you know, a lot of times you don't have to be the greatest musician to be the greatest instrumentalist. I mean, we worked with, when I was in Chicago, we did some stuff with Earth, Wind & Fire for a while. Verdine White's one of my favorite bass players in the world. But in terms of learning something, it took him a minute. He wasn't like you know, David Hungate. Or Mike Porcaro, or one of these guys that just goes, "What is it? What is it? Great, done."
Yeah.
It takes him a while to get it, you know, put it in his world and live with it for a minute. You know, it's a band thing rather than a
But wasn't Hungate a session player like Lukather?
Oh, yeah,
those guys were like, okay, roll it, boom.
Well, I think the fact that he was so good made him a session player. It wasn't the fact that he was a session player made him so good.
Oh, okay.
So it was whatever it was. I mean, he's one of the best musicians I've ever worked with. He's a monster. Monster. Absolute monster.
Mm-hmm.
Such great ears. It's ridiculous. All those guys, forget it. Toto should be on a government grant. You know? I mean, really.
Well, they were. They were a great.
Kind of. They still are, believe me. It's still smoking.
I mean, Boss Gags' album was all Toto.
Not quite, but close.
Yeah. I mean, they were on a lot.
Well, I mean, Jeff Beccaro, come on, give me a break. And Mike Beccaro, for that matter. And, you know, those guys are as good as it gets. And there's a tune in here that I had Steve Beccaro play on it, the one that you downloaded a little while ago, Only Way Down. I got some Steve. I just handed him the files and said, "Do it." And he came up with some of the coolest stuff on this record. Mm-hmm. He's a great musician. There's nobody in that band that shouldn't be there. I've worked with Joseph Williams a lot, and between the two of us, we arrange the shit out of everything we touch. It's really great.
Well, before I play that, let me play another one that shows the kind of. But we were talking about the layering of the guitars where it's kind of an orchestration right. in that sense. I'm going to play the clip, The Truth, and I cut two pieces together here. There is a lead in there, too, but the layer of the acoustic and electric guitars, I think, is a really good interplay here. So here's The Truth.
Selling me something I can get for free. Convince me that I'm winning. It ain't nobody spinning it. Lies, even you believe.
Will never be true.
Never be true.
Even you leave run out of fools.
And then no one listens to you.
You disguise all you creep, but the lies that you need. Tell the truth. Tell the truth. You want all that you see, but you
too.
That's a great cut.
Isn't that great? It's, you know, no wonder I stack all the guitars. Listen to the vocals. That's all one guy. Give me some tracks. I'm in trouble.
But that, I noticed there's, you know, after you were talking about Steve Cropper, in that acoustic guitar, you're doing a couple of those kind
of. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean.
Those are brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, in those spots, and acoustic, especially at that time, I was living in Nashville, so I was kind of leaning. I think we might have written it on guitar. It was actually Bruce and me wrote this song.
Mm-hmm.
And just for anybody's sake, it was George Hawkins on bass mm-hmm. and Billy Ward.
Okay.
Yeah, Billy Ward on drums. And some of the keyboard stuff sort of sounds like Vibes was Mark Ettinger who co-produced it with me.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a cool thing. We with that album we did, this was No Place Left to Fall album. It's a really good record. We kind of decided to do it a way that nobody had ever done it before, or nobody had done it lately. And that was, you go into a rehearsal hall with the guys, you arrange the shit in the rehearsal hall, then you go to a great studio with great mics and a great engineer, and you put it down. And that's what we did. And we got out of Nashville so nobody would go, hey, I'll be right back. I got to pick up the kids at school. We went to about 100 miles above Newark Airport in New Jersey in the wintertime. We went to this church up there that had a great studio in it and nothing else to do but this. And we all just went and did this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like really cool. It was like being in summer, you know, music summer camp. We got into it.
Well,
because the distractions were, what are you going to do in the wintertime on a lake in New Jersey? Nothing. Go back in and record more, you know. And we just, you know, we were going, hey, we're going to get it. People are going to say, hey, wow, that's a cool way of recording. Never thought of doing it that way. Rehearse it, you know, arrange it, rehearse it, and record it. Wow. Strange move,
straight,
huh?
Very.
And all at the same time. Yeah, wow. Because,
yeah.
I mean, nobody could afford to do that anymore.
That's
true. I see people sending files out and have a bass part put on in room 414 at a Holiday Inn somewhere, send it back, and it goes back on the record. The fact that you can do it doesn't mean that you should.
Right.
I won't produce anything. If I'm not there when it's going on the tape, it ain't going on the tape.
Mm-hmm.
Or the tape destination, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
I just don't produce that way. I can't do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing that I noticed in that clip is what you're doing guitar-wise was more counterpoint. You were going against a little bit of the...
Me and Bruce played two guitars together really well. A lot of guitar players, when I start playing with them, they kind of look at them, shouldn't you be on the organ? They just don't play well together with the other children. You know, mm-hmm. Somebody was talking about a guitar player once. He says, a lot of guys play with you. Some guys play at you.
Yeah.
You know?
Very true.
And it happens that way. And it doesn't mean that they're not good musicians. It just means that you're not going to get some of that interplay that we'd like to find. And Bruce loves my guitar playing. We did some jamming. So we did like once a month over at the Mint over on Crescent Heights,
mm-hmm.
right near Crescent Heights on Pico.
Mm-hmm.
And when it was half the size, and we played, it was Billy, the same drummer that you heard, different bass player. Mark Leonard was playing bass, and it was me and Bruce. And I had a little portable organ and a guitar and an amp. And Bruce and I would do these things together, and he always listened to what I'm doing. I listened to what he was doing. And between the two of us, we'd end up with some really cool stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we'd hit the wall, but that's what's cool about music. You know,
you got to try it to see if it works.
I like to run against the wind like this. And if the wind stops, yeah, I'm gonna land right on my face. But I was
right
running that way.
So you, let's talk a little bit about how you because you guys were all rehearsing this stuff. So you brought in a chord chart, and did you and the other guitar player already work it out, or kind of?
No, we would work. Actually, Bruce, we would go into the rehearsal and play it, and Bruce would write the charts real quick. And it was just basic charts, not even pushes or anything.
Right.
Just basics. I mean, it was just the way Bruce, you know, remembered the stuff himself. But once we got into the studio and started paying closer attention, it's like a rehearsal is sort of like a course adjustment on a microscope.
Right.
Then you get to the studio, and if you're in a real hurry, you can just do that. If you got Greg Fillinganes and John Robinson and Abe Laboreal and, you know, Steve Lukather or something like that, take one or two. It's probably going to be as good as you want to get.
Yeah.
But I kind of like the fact you go in and you hit the wall once or twice, listen to it back and go, wouldn't it be nice if you did this and I did this? And that came up 2 seconds before you put it on tape.
Yeah.
And you have a feel.
So you...
Oh, dig this. And if you got a guy that you work together well with, I mean, whenever Bruce and I play together, it's always a kick.
So with those...
And me and Carmen are the same way.
With those guys, you will ask for specific things then. So you, you're working it out, you say, well, hey, can you give me like this or...
Well, there's a tune on that album called No Place Left to Fall. And it's I've always had kind of a little bit of an acoustic-y, country, folky thing on almost mm-hmm. every album I've ever done. And what happened with that one is we were practicing it, and it was yet another one of Bill's acoustic-y, folky things. And then George was playing bass with us, and he said, and we were all kind of going, yeah, this would probably be nice, you know, just like the last album you did with the acoustic-y, folky shit that you did on that record. And all of them were great songs and everything, but it was sounding the same.
Yeah.
And Hawkins went, what if I played like a U2 bass part? Boom, 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 boom. Real eighthy thing on a real gentle ballad. And he started doing it, and it was like, ooh, this is going somewhere. And then Billy said, oh, wow, that's great. I'm going to play it with my hands. So he played it with his hands, and the song just went boom. And we didn't. We actually got that in rehearsal, mm-hmm. but that could have happened live or live in the studio, and I would have gone with it immediately. It was like, oh, you just saved the song. It wasn't gonna end up on the record because it was just. It's nothing yeah. killing me. And when George put that pulse in it, and Billy went, oh, you know, I mean, he didn't even touch the bass drum until the second verse. Mm-hmm. His floor tom was the bass drum, and he was hitting it with his hands. And so the way we mixed it, and it was, what was the mixer's name? He was great. It's just another name that went. My memory, I spent top dollar on my memory loss. He was mixing it like that was the bass drum, and then when the bass drum came in, it was boom. It was this big, giant thing. So the whole record just went, wow, right. like that at the second mm-hmm. verse. So it just carried you even further because it was just this song just built. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those just mistakes. And sometimes you stumble into the right shit that way. It's pretty cool.
It's, yeah, you'd be surprised. We hear it all the time in a lot of sessions. Let's go with that.
Yeah.
And it becomes the
and that's on that song. I mean, on The Truth, we kind of knew what we were going to do. We'd already demoed it. Played it. We had a little bit of an idea what we were going to do. I did a little cutting, and like there were originally four phrases on the front. I said, let's go with three. Two is not enough. Four is too many. Make it three, even though it's mathematically a little out of whack.
But it's not. I like that interplay. It really there's a syncopation that you do. You're very rhythmic oriented.
Oh yeah, I'm a drummer. What can I say? I am. Yeah, I play the drums. I don't play them very well anymore because all the gear is too good. I play great on shitty gear, you know.
Well, we have a little bit of time left. I'm going to play a quick clip of Stone Cold Hollywood, which is off that same album.
Cool.
And this is another one with the...
Have we blown the whole hour?
Almost.
Oh, man, dig this. Champlin and mouth off. I haven't even touched the electric.
But here, this one has dual leads. I have the dual lead. Yeah, so who's... This is you and
me, Bruce.
Bruce. Okay, take a listen.
Music to rob liquor stores by.
That now, which guitar did you use on that? Did you use this one?
On that, I was using. What the hell was I playing? Probably playing the Mene. I bet you anything.
The Mene.
I might have played one of Bruce's guitars. I mean, Bruce actually. What was cool is Bruce brought his dad used to have a music shop in Chicago and found these crazy amplifiers. I think the amp he played through was this old Gibson with a wood. Kind of look like a couple of treble clefs over the grill cloth
mm-hmm.
with this sort of a white maple looking wood, and that was the amp he played through. And he found me another one that was like just ridiculous, and we just put him in another room and went for it.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, before we go, I want you to play a little bit of this other guitar.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, this is HP. It's a Henry Polisi, a friend of mine, Arnie Vilches, said, "Man, you should have one of these things. These things are really cool guitar." I'm gonna pull it up. That's what I love about that tuner. It's also a mute.
Cool. And the way he has these pickups, the way they're wired, it's an interesting setup. And I'll let you explain it.
Well, it's a three position, and what it is on the treble, close to the treble pickup, there's the treble volume, which you would think would be at the bottom.
Right.
Because here's the pickup, you'd think it'd be here. But he set it up mostly for rock guitar players. And it feels like a Les Paul kind of.
Mm-hmm.
It's heavy, kind of a heavy guitar. And the volume for the treble is right there. I'm going to do it in clean for the moment. But usually there's a volume, and then there's another knob, and then there's volume for the bass pickup, and then another knob. And you would think the other knob would be tone. Well, it's not. It's actually... Say, here's the treble pickup. That's a single coil,
double coil.
So you can kind of go from Stratocaster to Gibson just with a... And then I usually... And then the bass pickup is the same thing. Here's single coil. And then... I think the double coil is better through this. Nasty little guy.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I usually play up here. And then it goes to single coil. You know what I mean?
No, it's got a great sound.
And treble is single. It sounds like a Strat, doesn't it?
Yeah. So
and then this. Sounds like a Gibson.
So he has the four knobs, and instead of a tone control, he has one that you can dial up to single coil.
He normaled the tone just to be up. Yeah. Most people don't do the tone things. Unless, I know Carlos, I mean, Eric on some of the Cream records, they turn the tone back just for that sort of violinish sound. Yeah, Carlos has been doing that a lot lately. He's just got that same kind of
thing. Yeah, Clapton called it the woman tone.
Yeah, whatever that was. You know, I was not really a big fan of that, but... it's some level, you gotta love it because it's forgiving.
Yeah,
that's why I always use chorus because I'm such a bad guitar player that I don't have a real consistent touch up and down, so my intonation gets a little shaky. You know, I can just overplay, overplay with this finger and underplay with another one, so I'm sharp on the one, flat on the other. With a little chorusing, it's a little forgiving. Just
right.
A bit forgiving.
But the style that you play, when you bend,
yeah.
It doesn't need to be precise. It can be a little bit off. It works. It's part of that sound, which is the...
Well, that was kind of what was weird about the Floyd. Using the Floyd was a little weird because you bend up like that and you can't get the other string into it. So I don't use them anymore. I mean, I had one on my... on the Mene, on any of the... Most of my other guitars, I got Floyds on them. But for the Strat that I use in the studio and this, I just pretty much keep it straight ahead.
Now,
play some stuff. Let's see what we got.
Well, I'm gonna take us out with the song that you produced for your wife.
Okay.
And I want to talk about it in a minute. But before that,
talk about rhythm. If you can, just play a little bit of Genius here.
Okay.
If you
let
got
me
it.
Play Genius. I have it here.
Just just to check out basically stacking, because we never really got around with too much stacking.
Great grooves.
Keyboard bass. I just went, hell with it. For I'm just going to use a patch. Moog, mini Moog were there, you know what I mean?
Well, real quick, what's happening now? A new album coming out?
Well, that album right there, that one, and so what are we going to go out with Cameron's thing?
Yeah, the
Dreaming of Chagall, yeah. Let's go out with that, but that's going to be on the record. There's a project that me and Gary Falcone, who's a great singer and guitar player, good lead guitar player.
Yeah, he sang with you that last show at the movies.
Yeah, he's a monster. He's a great guitar player. And then we started writing stuff for Tamara and I started writing stuff with him and for him, and we just kept going. Next thing you know, we had a pretty close to a record. Then I got the son's drummer, who's also Henderson's, who's a guitar player. Scott Henderson's
Scott Henderson.
Drummer. Yeah, it's Alan Hertz. Also played with Landau for a long time on Landau's Trio. He's a monstrous drummer, but he's a great mixer. Great Pro Tools engineer.
Oh, very cool.
With sick ears that he can go jazz ball on you. He understands punk. He understands jazz. He understands this stuff. He's the guy that I saw at the beginning to mix this stuff. So these are his mixes. They aren't mastered yet, but those things that you're hearing are his mixes. Mm-hmm.
Well, Dream of a Chagall, a lot of layers in this one, too.
That's all me on all the guitars. And I just got into a guitar rig and just started coming up with different sounds. And Tamara came up with a lot of parts and stuff. Says, mm-hmm. play this here and play this here. And there's a little piano on it, but it's really mostly guitars. I mean, even the B section goes to pretty serious.
Well, I want to thank acoustics. You for coming on the show. It's awesome. We ran out of time. We have to. There's much more.
I talk too much.
No. We could go on and on and on. Yeah. But some of the stuff that you're doing, I think it's vital to see how you arrange, because that's very key in that rhythm. All the clips that I played tonight, the strong sense of rhythm and that kind of funky groove.
Yeah,
that's good.
Well, I just realized that, you know, I mean, I've hung out with a lot of guitar players. Every band that I've ever had, I've always had a better guitar player than mm-hmm. me. Because, I mean, if I'm playing organ, I want somebody who's going to kick ass.
Yes.
And so then I get on guitar and he just kicks, not only kicks ass, he kicks me off the stage. But that's it's better for that. You know, when I get in the studio and everything, I approach guitar not as a guitar player, but as a composer.
Yeah.
So then I get what I know I can do and what will fit with other things that I can do, and then you have it.
Well, everybody check out No Place Left to Fall. It's a great album, and you have some of the best rhythm sections I've heard. They're just great.
Well, I like the cats.
Yes. Yeah. But this song is called Dreaming of Chagall.
Yeah, and it's got Alan playing drums on it also.
And everybody, we will see you next week. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, man, it's a blast. You definitely have to come back.
Hey, this was my son's birthday, and in a way I'd rather be here than hanging out with him. Because he's going to retune my damn guitar.
Thank you, Bill. And thank you, Lori Reamer, for hanging out with us and introducing me to Bill and making this show happen. Everybody have a great week. We'll see you next week.